Well, welcome everyone. So, it's a real pleasure for me to welcome Jeff Phelps to our poetry salon. Jeff is a poet and novelist. He's been published by London Magazine and Critical Quarterly, and his recent collection is Wolverhampton Madonna, which was published just in 2016 by Offers Press. Offers Press is based in Shropshire, isn't that right?
Yes.
And its watchword is good on the page and good on stage. So that's interesting. But it also is interesting because it runs a reading service for really what seems a very modest fee and mentoring opportunities. So I thought that might be something worth mentioning for everybody here. And also it's run as a cooperative with a number of poets
on the board.
On the board and involved. And so it just seems really quite an interesting model. Mm. Yeah, really, it is doing very well. So definitely worth a look. And obviously Jeff Phelps as well has made various contributions to the regional writing scene, including as a founder of Bridge North Writers Group in 1991, and that group is still an active and creative force.
Still going strong, yes.
Yeah, which is absolutely wonderful. So one of the poems in the pamphlet, Wolverhampton Madonna, is River Passage, and that came second in the Stand Open Poetry Competition. And it's also available on CD set to piano music by Dan Phelps.
Yep.
So that's
awesome.
Something to look out for. So please join me to welcome Jeff Phelps to the
Thank you, Chloe. Thanks for that great introduction, and it's lovely to be here in such colourful surroundings. Wonderful, thank you. I'm actually going to read a little bit from River Passage. Thank you for mentioning that. I live in Bridge North, and River Passage was a long poem I wrote about the river in Bridge North and about some things that went on there. As Chloe mentioned, it's once I'd written it, I sent it in for the Stand competition, and it won second prize. And somebody said, "Oh, you really ought to do something with that now." So I asked my son to write some music, and he's a pianist, lives in Cardiff, and he wrote some wonderful, tinkly, watery piano music. So we did a CD. It's also, which I don't think's on mentioned there, an app of all things. So you can actually download it from the, I think it's called the Apple Store. So this is a little tiny bit out of River Passage. It's really a narrative poem, so you just need to... The idea is that you're following different people down the river. In this particular section, it's about Richard, who's in a sort of a kayak at this point. It's probably all you need to know. Suddenly he is swept round by the current, feels the stern go, and the glasses slip through his fingers. He reaches for them, tries to catch, like catching fish with your hands. They bounce on his fingertips, slip from the deck, and he has reached too far. He always goes too far, he thinks, as he topples, loses it. With a shoulder, he smacks green water, breathes filthy bubbles. Now, upside down, Richard thinks he sees the glasses shimmer up through floating green galaxies, like spots you get before your eyes, dislocated particles of retina. He could almost touch them even now, but for the different geometry of underwater, where there's no time to breathe, where everything moves in slow motion. Richard remembers the drill, is surprised that even here instinct snaps into place. He tries to paddle himself upright, but something traps him, is stronger than paddles, than the desperate torque of shoulder muscles. He recognises it as the clutch of a branch, or worse, the unexpected concentric gravity of a whirlpool. One night, 2 years ago, a lad went in upstream from here. The river has the body now. Never found. The town riddled with underwater mazes, carved sandstone gullies with entrances. no exits. 200 miles of water keeping him in place, feeling his pockets for identity, searching the hair. The boy lives underwater, bone loved to the sandstone. All the money out of his pockets, credit cards gone, washed away. He crouches under 1,000 years of sandstone, like a fetus in decaying denim, stonewashed by the river. Before he turns, Richard, inverted, afraid to breathe, looks him in the eye. Then he is righted, paddles, splashes, gasps. He never knew how precious air could be, what he would have given for air then. Green water slides off the deck, and he opens his eyes as if for the first time ever to reeds and willows and smell of water, the sound of traffic on the bypass, and the sun, water sliding past it. I'll stop there for that one. I think one or two that aren't in Wolverhampton Madonna. This one's called Cherry Blossom in Futaba. Futaba was severely affected by the Fukushima nuclear disaster, the earthquake and the tsunami, and it was evacuated en masse. So we were asked to write about cherry trees, I think, so it was called Cherry Blossom in Futaba. There were several phases of cherry blossom there. Kayaka is in its very early stage, and Mankai is the fully formed cherry blossom. For 5 years now, the Kayaka has come unseen. It achieves Mankai, and like a bride's doffed dress, falls on Mr. Carmo's gravel garden. It is dense with decay. The furrows which Mr. Carmo so carefully raked around the single cherry are ripples stilled on a pond. Only the chaffinch turns over blooms in search of mealworms. A lean cat skips the ridges. In his daughter's flat in Kobe, Mr. Carmo gathers blossom in his dreams, lets it go, watches it sift away in half lives. And this one, quite close to us, there are some wonderful fields. They slope from the horizon almost down to the road. And as you drive past them, I used to drive past them every day to work, sometimes they'd be sort of ploughed, and other times they'd be just fallow. So this is called Song of the Ploughed Field. I wondered for a long time how to write about these fields. I just was aware that they were lovely things. So this is kind of from the viewpoint of those fields. Only a juggins such as I allows himself to be so used by fertility and fallowness in turns. Over the music the ploughman plays in his tractor cab, he's raging against my rocks and tears, he's all day ravelling over the cockshut, pleating me to the earth with gulls. Sometimes I hear him sing. Though I give everything, there is no love between us, only work and seed and sometime reaping. Yet once by the patched up glat, he picked an ochre handful of my tilth and put it to his nose like wine. And how else to describe the way he teases every landlocked strand of me into lines you could sight a horizon with, turns for the 40th time at the cop, combs me sweetly back downhill. I suppose that's a kind of a love story to the between the farmer and the field, obviously. This is a kind of a visual one. You have to imagine that circle. I haven't managed to do that on the computer yet. Although I have asked a very talented artist if she can do it for me. And it's about, it's called Heartwood, and it's about a chopped tree, really. So when it says this spot and here, I imagine a sort of nail or one of those lovely diamond things drilled in at that exact spot. So this is about a tree, it's called Heartwood. You might describe me by dendrochronology, saying, for instance, how this spot marked the time of some distant tragedy of which I was unaware, or here, the end of society as you knew it. None of it is of consequence to me. My years are wrapped up far more tightly. No, I would say that here I felt an earthquake through my roots. The heartwood here is where I once was greenest. And this thick seam made a summer of bursting energy. Here, two sappy lovers talking of eternity carved out scars in my thigh. These are the circles I remember patiently. Peeling bark, moss, magpie, canopy. Here is the night the great wind thinned me. At this last ring, I was sawn through, finally. I think Sarah Jane knows about this, don't you? This is, we were asked to write about on the subject of Onwards Upwards Freedom for Poetry on Loan this year. Quite a difficult subject, actually, because it's so wide, isn't it? So vast. And I wrote this one taking a sort of a scant look at freedom. It's called The Idiot's Guide to Freedom. I locked myself inside my room with 100 books on freedom. I thought they might improve my life, so started out to read them. I soon released my inner child, unfettered my career. I manifested mindfulness, yet still I was no freer. It seemed this self-improvement lark was tougher than I'd thought, for I was still locked up indoors with all the books I'd bought. So I made a staircase from them to the window and climbed through. And there, at last, I understood. I spread my wings and flew. And those postcards are in all the libraries around the West Midlands, I think. Free, I've got some tonight. If anybody wants them, do take them. I'll read a few more from... I'll read a few more from here. This is one I wrote for my son when he went off to university. Note of caution for a son going off to university. Of midnight encounters with the law, of pubs that lock the inner door, of too much detergent in the washing machine drawer, be careful. Of women who say, I'll call you back, of botulism, little chef, Big Mac, of dandruff, pyorrhea, plaque, be careful. Of the condom borrowed from a well-meaning friend, of accelerating into an unlit bend, of staying at the party till the bitter end. Please, be careful. When mixing metaphors, mixing drinks, avenging pranks, creating stinks, studying all night or unblocking sinks, at least try to be careful. Of being self-righteous, intolerant of vice, of being impatient, of being too nice. And regarding poems spiked with advice, son, be careful. And I kind of had to write one for my daughter to sit at the other end of the book market, I suppose. This is one I wrote for her some time ago. First boyfriend. Your boyfriend bought you flowers. Glynn, you said was his name. Two bunches, one of roses and one of yellow tulips, both wrapped in supermarket cellophane. The label on the tulip said, guaranteed to last at least 5 days. And I remembered what you'd told me. One day I'll get flowers from a boy. Not that long ago. A prophetic turn of phrase. He texted you 3 times a night and phoned you in between. You said it was flattering, yet somehow oppressive. And anyway, he kissed like a washing machine. I admired the way you knew what you wanted. Even at your age, those budding intuitive powers. Yet I still felt kind of sorry for your boyfriend. Kissed and dumped within a fortnight. He lasted hardly longer than his flowers. And this one. I don't know whether people know Wells Cathedral. It's not that far from here, really, is it? It's a wonderful cathedral, and there's a wonderful chapter house there, which is actually raised up, which is quite unusual, I think. And from that chapter house down into the body of the cathedral is a wonderful stone set of staircases, which are sort of flow in several directions. So this poem is called Wells. The chapter house is placid as a pond. One slender column spurts and overspreads, spatters into rib and lily frond, cascades over alcoves with sculpted heads of long-gone clergy, ugly, ordinary men whose voices bubble to the surface, rise and dip. It is these stairs that beckon them again, like the way to heaven treads eroded to a lip by 700 years of heels before us. Waters meet at a curving, brimming weir. If stones could sing and light was the chorus, these stairs are what we would hear. Prayer pouring from the chapter house tower, sluicing down into every cloistered hour. I think somebody mentioned it was Christmas. this one's called Round Robin. It's the last one I'll do of this little part, I think. You're welcome to photocopy this and send it to all your friends. I don't know whether people get or send round robins or what they think of them. So this poem's called Round Robin. Delete as appropriate. So you can actually delete the bits of this poem that you don't, you know, need. I'll have to do a little line in the air for where the hashes come. Round Robin. Delete as appropriate. Dear uncle, cousin, nephew, distant friend, how are you? Where's this year gone already at its end and Christmas upon us? Please excuse the lateness of this note, but I've had a bad shock, dream, bank balance, throat. Doesn't time fly? Next year I promise to write and arrange a meet-up. How about Wetherspoons, Tesco's, the Isle of Wight? Jason, Kevin, Tara, Kate did the GCSEs this summer. Got 12, 6, none. Other. Well done to him, stroke her. What a bummer. Family halls were in Tenerife, Tenby, the Transit, Korea. We swam, golfed, argued, got lucky, arrested, lost, diarrhea. Peter, Alice, Richard, Jill says she, he, loved, despised it there. So we're suing the company, emigrating. buying timeshare. Mother is still working, grappling, sleeping with her poodle, psychiatrist, debt advisor. But none of us are getting any younger, nookie, richer, wiser. That's all from me, sending joy and peace from your loving cousin, uncle, auntie, nephew, niece, for a Christmas that's happy, fantastic, festive, neat, and full of seasonal love, love, love. No need to delete. Thank you.
A lovely way to end the first half with a chorus of all.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Great reaction, thank you.
And thanks for the humour as well in those poems that you've read. I think it's quite a rare art, if I may say, I think, to be able to really...
I just do like humour. I mean, it doesn't mean that a poem isn't serious,
no,
I don't think,
no.
just because there's humour in it, and it makes you look at the poems in a slightly different way, I think.
Yeah.
So, yes, but not always humour in my poems. Some of them are quite serious in a serious way, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, because the River Passage poem, there's a, you know, that long narrative poem that you read a little bit of at first.
I did, yes.
There's definitely a sense of storytelling in your work, I think, in quite a lot of the poems.
Yes, and that one's a particularly long narrative poem because it runs to about 5 or 6 pages.
Yeah.
And it follows characters almost in a novelistic way, I suppose, through along the river, it sort of circles back. So it has a kind of circular feel to it, I think. But yes, it is very... It is a very narrative technique, that, and that occurs in some of the others too. But I like poems to be clear. That's something I kind of work towards, I think.
I think I saw that. I mean, with the River Passage poem, there is a sort of cinematic quality, as you say. Like, it does echo the river, the way a river moves in a tumbly sense.
Yes.
Which is lovely. But it does have this sweeping and honing in and honing back.
And, and passing on one... vision or one sensation from one character to the others. That's what kind of happens. And then, as I say, circles back to the first character again. Yeah. So it kind of echoes that circular motion of the river, I suppose. And lots of geometry in that one as well.
Yeah.
the character is a teacher, and so there's lots of sort of geometrical allusions in it. And again, you get that in the river. You know, there's lots of those sort of things.
Yes, that's it. And there's, for me reading it, there was a moment of complete sort of suspense. There's something that seems about to happen, and you go, and then the poem moves, and it's, I suppose it's, is it rare to experience a poem like that? I'm not sure, but, you know, that sense of that drive within a poem, that telling a story, but as you say, also with the geometry or the patterns or the shapes.
I don't know which moment you mean,
no,
in a way.
No, I'm not
going to
say, because it's a cliffhanger for the audience. I'll ruin it.
But I know I have learned...
You'll have to buy the book,
you have to buy it,
read
yeah.
the poem.
Yes, that's right. I know I have... I think I have learned some of those techniques from writing fiction.
Right.
You know, some of the stuff that drives somebody through a novel or through a story, and I, not consciously, I don't think, in that particular case, but I did, you know, look at driving it through, and it was a... kind of an interesting, well, not cliffhanger exactly, but passing from one section, from one person to another. And again, somewhere like Bridgnorth, and maybe somewhere like here in Ledbury too, they're not huge places, and there's a real sense that one person will know another person, or if not actually know them, will have a connection with them in some way. Yeah. And so that's I think, was in my mind as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, lovely. And did you have to do quite a lot of research, or did you just know the stories from life, or were you making them up? Or
there was quite a well-known local story about somebody who had gone in inverted commas, off the bridge, on New Year's Eve, I think
okay,
it was.
Okay, so that.
And so it was a sort of folk, almost like a folk tale. And you know how when that happens, the stories always come out about it. You know, did they jump? Did they argue with their girlfriend? Were they? All this sort of stuff. And that's how it works in small towns.
Yeah.
And so I was, again, quite interested in that as a sort of, you know, as a legend almost, how legends and stories come about. But I didn't have to do a huge amount of research. I'd written it in a sort of very fluid form, put it away as one often does, I think, with poems, and then took it out again and wrote it through fairly quickly, which I'm almost ashamed to say that I wrote it fairly quickly and didn't tinker with it hugely. I did a bit, but one embarrassing thing was I got the fish wrong. Somebody said, no, you can't have carp in the River Severn. So I had to change that in a recent edition. I'm a fisherman, he said, you can't have carp in the River Severn. Okay.
But it's a poem, you can have anything.
poetic license. Yes, maybe.
Yes, you just don't necessarily want a fisherman coming up to you at every poetry reading.
No, that's true. So you got the wrong fish again. Yes, no, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting you mentioned about how you think a poem should be clear.
Yeah.
So do you feel quite a kind of strong sense of what you're trying to achieve with your poems as you write in terms of what you believe poetry should be or how or what it...
I can't really say, particularly when I start off.
Yeah.
And I guess a lot of the poets here would say the same. I don't really know what I'm driving at the time when I begin. Like with The River Passage, I certainly didn't know.
Mm.
It felt like a real journey, which it is. And that's true of most of the poems, I think. And it's only when you've written them, you know, you've written them and you go back to them and you say, oh... So that's what I was driving at, if you like, and that works for me. But I think what certainly interests me in poems is the sense that there's something that when I read a poem that, you know, gets to me, and then I start to look a bit deeper and I can say, oh, actually there's more going on there.
Yeah.
And it's that first, without that first sort of, I suppose, bit of interest, Again, personally, I'm not always tempted to look further in poems. So that's why I like my poems to be quite clear, because I think that's more inviting, I suppose.
Right, yeah.
On a first read, and then hopefully people will find more if they read them again.
Okay, and so choices do you think you're making then when you're aiming for that clarity? I'm curious to know.
I'm aiming to make the poems... just comprehensible on a surface level, I think.
Okay.
So that people don't get to the end of a poem and think, what was that all about?
Yeah.
You know, right. I just don't get it, you know.
Okay.
And then maybe don't never look at it again.
Okay.
I mean, I know that's not a very always a fashionable approach, because some poems that I read, I do have that, I do find that, I do read them and I think, oh, I just... don't understand that poem.
I think it's got to connect, hasn't it?
Got to be maybe that's the word. Maybe that's the word.
That universal connection.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah. How do you do that? How do you make that connection?
And whether you have a sense of what you're doing.
I have a sense of what I'm doing more when I'm editing.
Right.
I think.
Yeah.
Because I've got something there that I can sort of work towards. It depends on the poem. I mean, you know, if like that Wells one, I was very conscious of trying to convey what it was like to be in that place.
Mm.
At the same time, trying to convey what the amazing history was like, and what the particularly, because I was an architect, so I got a strong sense of place, I think. Of what those wonderful flowing stairs were like to stand at the top of and see all this history sort of flowing down. And how do you struggle towards putting all that in, you know, in 14 lines or whatever, you just keep tackling it, don't you? And you keep honing it and you put it away and you think, I'm not very close, and then you think, oh, maybe I, that's a bit better. So it's a sort of iterative, I think, intuitive. Is the way of doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that makes sense to anybody at all, but that's the way
it's... interesting that you say, when you say that you're an architect.
Yeah.
I felt that you really place yourself very much in the material quality of the place that you're in, whether it's the tree or the field or the building.
Yes.
It's almost as if you become that place.
Yeah,
that
places
place.
are important to me, I think. I mean, I do feel that, you know, there are times when I could put more of myself in, you know, and that's something that somebody has commented on, that I don't put that much of myself, which is, again, perhaps quite unusual, but I do find places fascinating. And both my novels, actually, are sort of very place-centred. You know, they're very, very much about places, although I think the characters come out too. So, yes, place is important to me, and location, and trying to describe what it's like to be in fields or trees or...
Well, and how to be a field as well.
Yes, yes. But I kind of see that as just a different perspective. You know, it's very easy, isn't it, to drive past these fields and say, right, I'm going to write about the fields, and because lots of people do that. Mm. And so I was looking, in that case, for a different way of doing it. Just a different approach. I drove there, and there was a woman whose car broke down, and I helped her to fix the car. It was a tyre needed changing. And she said, oh, what are you doing here? Because it was in the middle of nowhere. And I said, well, you won't actually believe me if I tell you, you know, who in their right mind goes into the middle of nowhere to look at a field, apart from maybe poets. And she said, oh, because I said, I feel a bit strange because, you know, I'm trying to write about this field. And she said, well, you know, the farmers don't actually see the fields in anything other than in a very business-like way, she told me. And so that gave me a bit of an in, really, because it was a sort of a tension between the beauty of the field and the very workmanlike way in which I think a lot of country people do see them, you know, and they're just things in which they plant and which yield, you know, year after year, you know, just without saying anything, they just keep doing it miraculously. Yeah.
Isn't it a bit like Eric Ravelius's drawings of fields?
I suppose it is.
He's always looking at fields.
I do love those, but I... Yeah.
How to use it.
I do love those, but I didn't have those in mind at the time. But they're just wonderful, those. Yeah. There's a real sense of, I don't know, wonder at the landscape, isn't there? And at the contrast and at the...
Pattern.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I hadn't thought of that, actually. But yes, they are those sort of fields at certain times of the year. And other times they're quite just just grass. Yeah. So yes, they're amazing. They're lovely fields. I recommend them to anybody.
And I noticed as well, I think it was in that one, wasn't it, that you used quite a few dialect words or words specific,
I did.
Either to the ploughing or the place.
Yes, I did have to do some research on those. Those are actually Shropshire kind of yokel type words, or I should say old words. Cockshut, which is actually a place in Shropshire, but I didn't know, and I had, as I say, I had to research it. It's a sort of place where they shut in the pheasants, I think. Oh, you know this word, do you?
We have lots of them around.
Oh, do you? Cockshoots, yes, that's right. And the glat is a hole in the fence as well.
Uh-huh. These are built structures, you mean? Like
no, I think a glat is, again, if you're a farmer, you know, there's a hole in the fence, we've got to mend the glat, I think, is the kind of sense of it.
Yeah.
So it's words that, you know, people like me would never need to use.
Yeah.
But I was fascinated to find that there were words for these sort of country things, and interested to think of a field itself maybe using words like glat and shucks and cockshut. I can't remember what the other one was.
Yeah.
There was another one.
Tilth.
Tilth, exactly. Yes. That's a great, that's a lovely word. Yeah. That is a lovely word, isn't it? It's got its own substance and its own... Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right,
which
yes.
Which the universality of it, like the terroir.
Yeah, yes, that's right. Yeah, yes, yes. So I haven't had that one published, but I have sent it off actually to you. You were mentioning the Interpreter's House, so I've sent it off to them, see what they think. We'll see, yes.
Oh,
yes.
So how do you decide what, when you send off a poem to a competition, or, you know, do you have any way of choosing?
They're almost self-limiting. I mean, I've got a lot in here now.
Yeah.
So they obviously can't go off to 99% of competitions.
But why River Passage, for instance, rather than something else? Is it
again, in a very prosaic purpose, I'd written this long poem about the river, and suddenly up popped this competition for long poems.
Oh, it is for long poems.
It was for long poems.
Yes, it makes sense,
so I thought, what can I do? Perfect. So I sent it serendipity. How could I refuse?
Yeah.
So they hardly ever come up, as far as I know. And so I sent it off to them.
Yeah.
That was Stand, yes, and they were pleased with it.
Yeah.
And that's a great magazine. I don't see it so much these days, but it certainly was a great magazine to be in. And then, I mean, you just keep writing and then keep sending, I think, is the kind of recipe. I know Joe Bell has got a great... sort of methodology for sending off, which is quite ruthless. I don't know whether anybody's come across it. It's online. I think you just put a list of all your poems and you just, you know, ruthlessly every month choose 3 or 4, send them off, you know.
Right, a sort of don't, spreadsheet. Of
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because she reckons that's the only way you're going to get a regular, your poems regularly in magazines. Mm. It sounds a bit sort of... you know, it sounds a bit academic or a bit, you know, sort of...
Business-like.
Yeah, business-like. But maybe you have got to be business-like to achieve, you know, a regular appearance in magazines and competitions.
Mm.
I think competitions are different to magazines, personally. You know, that things that win competitions aren't the same ones that go in a magazine, I don't think. You know, magazines are looking for regular material, aren't they? And so every whatever, they're looking for stuff to put in, whereas a competition, they're looking for something that really, one poem perhaps that stands out, maybe 2 or 3. And you're completely at the sort of whim of the of the judges, and who knows, you just I would advise not to try and second guess judges, because it doesn't work in my humble opinion and experience. Don't, you know, if I've known people who say, oh, I know such and such, I'll send them this poem. No, don't bother.
There we are.
Send them your best, I think, just for competitions.
Yeah, the one you love the most.
The one you love the most, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
And so, place poems and also conversation poems.
Yes.
Conversations. I mean, you have poems, a poem written for Seamus Heaney.
I have.
And a poem for your mum.
Yes.
Which was a lovely poem, Inventing My...
Yes, I'll read that one in a second.
Yeah, that's... would you like to talk at all about that?
The Seamus Heaney one is quite interesting. It's called Wine Glasses.
Yeah.
I'll read that the second bit as well. And that's a good example of not really knowing where it was, what it was about. I wrote about a very simple job of, you know, washing wine glasses. And there is an allusion in there to you, which I put in. And then when it was published by Office Press, the editor, Simon Fletcher, said to me, who's this you? And then I had to remember that it was actually Seamus Heaney that I had in mind, you know, about the way that he's just turned something suddenly in language, just very suddenly, where you think you're reading about something and then suddenly, wow, you know.
Yeah.
And I realised that sort of piece of magic, which is a glass in just holding itself there, is almost what I felt with his poems. So that really wasn't written to him until it was sort of unearthed, I had had him in mind, especially for that particular part.
Mm.
The one about my mum was interesting too. All these poems have their stories, I suppose. Mm. When my mum died, we found some love letters. And again, I think this happens quite a lot. We knew there was this story that she'd been in love with, I suppose you could say, a Polish soldier, I think he was. But it wasn't talked about much.
Right.
And there was a sort of a decision that she made. And I, when she died, there was some letters, and there was actually a menu, I think, from a restaurant, and those sort of things. Very, very personal, touching things.
Yeah.
And I knew this story, but I didn't know how to write it. And then again, we were in a workshop, and somebody presented this poem by, I forgot the name.
It's in the book. It's a lovely poem, Lynn Emanuel.
Thank you.
Scott as the.
That's right.
Heading, so
by Lynn Emanuel, called Inventing Father in Las Vegas, and she'd invented this story for her father. And straight away I knew, gosh, this is how I can approach it.
Yeah.
So it just led me in.
Yeah.
And again, once I had that idea, I just wrote it very quickly, embarrassingly quickly, almost all in that workshop, which is really rare, you know. And I followed her setting out and then departed from it.
Yeah.
So it was a great, and I would recommend that to anybody who's kind of looking for a way in. You know, if you can find a poem that speaks to you in that way.
Mm.
Somebody just presented it at this workshop,
mm.
and there it was, you know. Mm. And so, yes, I found I could, an approach that worked for me.
Yes. And it
seems,
yes, to talk about this feeling that you wished your mother had gone. And is that wrongly read? Or
it was not so much wish as giving her the choice, you know, or giving her the option, giving her the...
she didn't have.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Or saying, you could have, you know, I know you could have done.
Yes,
yeah, I think
that's
perhaps what I had in mind.
Yes, exactly.
Talking about clarity.
I think that's what I meant. Yeah.
But no,
yes.
I mean
it's a lovely... I do think it's such a beautiful poem. And, of course, the Wolverhampton Madonna is the poem on the front cover.
Yes.
Which was written in response to a picture. Are you planning to read
that? I shall read that one as well, as it's coming up to Christmas.
It is, yes. It's a poem. Perfect.
It is.
Perfect poem for Christmas.
It is.
I'm just putting in all my requests.
Yeah, I'll make sure I read those.
Now, before I
I'll make sure I read Wolverhampton Madonna.
Stage. And so, I think that it seems like a really good moment now to hear some more poems.
Okay.
But does anybody want to have any final questions or thoughts before we have our last 10 minutes of poems? Okay, well, Jeff will be here in the interval and does have pamphlets at the back, so you can continue the conversation then.
Thank you. Thank you, Chloe. Yes, I will make sure I read some of those. Thank you for those requests. I'm sure I can fit them in now. As I said, I live in Bridge North, which is on the River Severn. This one is called Goose Girls. A call from a childhood I never owned. Two barefoot girls on the river island. Stumbling over rocks, they stoop to pick up feathers and thread them in their hair, heavy as curling papers, strong as goose wings. They look up and wave, hoot with laughter. Then they are gone. There is only white litter in the stones. Geese battling the stream, two in flight. I hear the gentle gust of air and beak blow. The rattle of wing beats, and I am left on the parapet like Daedalus, begging them to fly close, to be careful, to stay wild.
Yes.
Back to the slightly humorous ones, which some people might connect with. Cooking in a bedsitter. I was in a bedsitter in the 1970s, and this book by Catherine Whitehorn sort of saw me through my days. So this is Cooking in a Bedsitter. Catherine Whitehorn, Penguin 1970 edition. She's still around, Catherine Whitehorn, I think, still writing for the Times, is it? Sunday Times. You talked me through my first shy fumblings with white bread dipped in egg, then fried. French toast, you called it. You always were a slice above the rest of us, your seasoned words making cordon bleu of our daily eggy bread. Cooking in a bedsit was ever thus, the baby belling with its single ring, the thin aluminium saucepan. You turned me, Catherine, from gauche milksop to assured student, showed me the gradual, patient foreplay of flour and milk, the fulminating miracle of bechamel sauce. Then you and I were as easy with chicken a la king as scrambled egg on toast. Oh, how that toast still scorches in my heart. Everything I know about long grain and basmati I learned from you. Alas, it's all behind us now. We both moved on as we knew we must. I have an oven, fan assisted, a microwave, and meals so instantaneous it would have made you weep. Yet, Catherine, we share much more than memories. The other day, I came across our paperback. It opened in my hand, pages loose as lasagna leaves. That chicken curry recipe we loved so much, still brown with spattered ghee. One about the family. Some part of my family are from South Wales, and this is called In the Blood. I kind of discovered that my great uncle was a conscientious objector and a socialist, and it was kind of kept quiet, not talked about much in the family. And this is about my discovery, really, of that. It's called In the Blood. I always thought our family was staunchly loyal. Alec at D-Day, blowing German tanks apart. Dad with the signals on Belgian soil. These were the adventures I knew by heart, and only later learned of great Uncle Bill, Welsh socialist and conchy to the end, who campaigned with Keir Hardie and wouldn't kill some German boy who might have been his friend. When the redcaps came, Gran hid him double quick in the coal shed, bit her chapel tongue and told a lie. Still, he spent his war in Cardiff Nick, chopped wood beneath a chilly English sky. I remember him, much later, old and lean, sitting in Gran's parlour. There was shame, unmentioned like a dormant family gene that might emerge in one of us again. Courage comes in many forms, for sure, and I was never called, so I don't know. But I suspect I would have gone to war, like all those brave lads terrified to go. But Uncle Bill, obeying a different call, risked rifles, blindfold against a wall. Right. Time for the three requests. I'll start off with the wine glasses, which Chloe so kindly referenced. I'm particularly pleased about this about this poem, because the emergency poet, who I know has been here at the festival here, has picked it up and put it in her anthology, and she also gave it out at Addenbrooke's. She tells me it's about the sacrament of the mundane, which was a great compliment, so I was very pleased about it. So it's called Wine Glasses, and yes, it's in memoriam Shane Assini. Wine glasses must be washed first, in water hot as hands can bear, untainted by the everyday of cutlery and plates. Rub out the deep red lees, invert them stems up to stand like potter's kilns. I think I had forgotten what a poem was, till you reminded me how the world can be made to scintillate on a single wavelength. Now I hold the glass up to the light. The taut, brittle arc of its bowl is faith in the impossible. I rub a moist finger round the rim. Here, a kind of gathering, a resonance that's neither glass nor air, but a new place between. Its high sound fills the kitchen like a prayer bell. And this is the one about my mum. Inventing Mother in London. As we mentioned, it's after Lynn Emanuel's poem called Inventing Father in Las Vegas. If I could see nothing but the smoke from her Kensitas, I would know everything about that trip to the Palladium. If her lips were dark with Elizabeth Arden, I would know this was a street in Kensal Rise, a hotel room with a sign over the pavement, her nylons across the back of a chair, the restaurants grey and navy with uniforms. I could be the glamour of that meal she shared with her Polish airmen. I would be the rush of air at her kissed mouth in the underground at Piccadilly. If I could become the trumpeter busking the queue in the West End, the pavement would be slick with bus light and she would put a penny in my hand. I would read the programme through her eyes, fold it and use the opera glasses from the seat in the gods, squeezing his hand for fear of falling. If I could be the choice she made, whether to stay with him or return, I would say go, go, and invent myself in the process. And finally, this one, the cover photo. Yes, it's Christmas, almost. It's Advent at least, isn't it? This is the picture, painted by Marianne Stokes, who's an interesting character. She and her husband, Adrian Stokes, used to go around sort of Eastern Europe in the early 1900s. She was very keen on the costumes and on the characters. He was good at the landscapes and the settings. And they had an exhibition in Wolverhampton Art Gallery. You might have seen this picture on the second-class Christmas stamps in 2005, so it's quite well-known. And it is actually belongs in Wolverhampton Art Gallery. It's not often brought out, it's often in storage, which is a real shame, I think. And for that reason, it's called the Wolverhampton Madonna by some people. And that title itself kind of set me thinking about Madonnas and where you might come across holy people, I suppose. So it's Madonna and Child. You might have seen her in Queen Square, or standing opposite Beatty's with her child, just a babe in arms, asked, how did she afford that blood-red cloak, the dark velvet lapels? A charity shop? Some soft-hearted passerby? You will have recognised the appealing tilt of her head. It makes you feel bad just for being there. Makes you want to cross the road. Her baby is wrapped in crepe bandage, of all things, on what looks like a net curtain. Another charity job. Both have those fine-boned East European features and such eyes. Aegean blue. Not accusing exactly, and not proud, more resigned. Asking nothing, but questioning everything. You can see it on the streets any day. The way some mothers use their babies for sympathy to squeeze a quid out of you. Her hand slips from the warmth, lifts to show his face. But all you think is he could do with warm milk inside him. You'll have seen her outside the train station, by the magistrate's court, or sometimes, as this evening, waiting on a patch of waste ground before golden brambles, some loose angelica, a harvest moon for halo.